Following program has adult language and plenty of spoilers. Listener, be advised.
Welcome to the Marvel Superheroes Podcast. I'm Diablo Frank. With me are Mr. Fixit and Illegal Machine.
Hello.
For those of you who've never heard the podcast before, we're going to curse a lot, and we don't we don't understand appropriateness very well. But we are participating in the Superblog team-up crossover under the subject tag Multiversity, and we're going to cover a book that not very many people read, including most of the people in this room, Dr. Zero. But before we're going to get to that, I'm going to put on my professor hat, and we're going to do some vocab. Gentlemen, can you tell me what a fanzine is?
A fan-made magazine that's mailed out to same-minded people.
What's a prozine?
A what?
Prozine.
I think a medication, ain't it?
That's a medication. Side effects include diarrhea, headache, high blood pressure.
Anal leakage.
Your erection lasts for longer than 4 hours. Go see your physician.
Prozine is just like a fanzine, except it's done by professionals. And usually,
what do you call a magazine?
Witzend was put together by comic book greats like Wallace Wood and Steve Ditko. They wanted to do work that wouldn't be allowed under the Comic Code Authority, work that wouldn't be edited by somebody who's trying to dictate to them what they're going to talk about and how they're going to talk about it. Often, they would have nudity and greater violence than normal comic books, but they still had to stay within certain guidelines because a lot of states had obscenity laws and you wouldn't be able to mail this stuff across state lines if they didn't match that up. The prozines usually didn't make much more money than fanzines, but it was an opportunity for creators to actually do creation as opposed to commercial art that they were used to having to produce. Another term, underground comics.
Crumb.
Pretty good starting point. But yeah. What exactly though? What defines them?
Comics outside the norm. Subject matter that's usually not touched upon.
Right. And when do they get their start?
Well, I watched the Crumb documentary, so I'm assuming in the 60s?
California, yeah, San Francisco, yeah. You had these guys who were, they wanted to go just completely out of balance and using the comic book medium to explore whatever subject matter they wanted to without regard for any sort of censorship. Often a lot more graphic and offensive in its subject matter than any comic books before. They were able to sell those because they went outside of normal distribution networks. They went to head shops and sold it to stoners. It was the 60s, so there was a feeling of liberty, artistic expression. They were actually able to make money off this stuff. They would create a comic book and it would go through printing after printing. You could make a living doing it all of a sudden by going completely non-commercial. All the guys who worked in underground comics were essentially amateurs until they started making money, and then they became guys like Robert Crumb. Once the underground comics made it clear that you could make money doing the stuff that you wanted to do and working outside the big companies, just like with fanzines, the comic book pros wanted some of that action too. You had enterprises like Star Reach, where professionals like Jim Starlin, Howard Chaykin, Frank Bruner would go off and do creator-owned works. Instead of just selling the stuff through mail order, they actually managed to get some distribution networks going. They didn't necessarily make very much money at it, but they still owned that material. And a lot of those guys managed to get that stuff reprinted into the 80s and onward and still make money off the stuff that they made back in the 70s, which of course doesn't happen very often with mainstream comic books that they would have produced in that same time period. By the late 70s, early 80s, you had companies like Pacific and Eclipse popping up where they were full-on companies. They actually had staff so you could make money with these creator-owned projects to the point where big-name talent were getting lost by the majors. You also had Heavy Metal Magazine, of course, coming up, where that was a collection of works from European artists that were getting imported into the United States. Marvel wanted a piece of that action. I'll tell you what do you guys know about Warren?
About who?
The magazine company Warren.
Then they print Vampirilla.
And Creepy and Eerie.
Yeah, I remember reading those.
You remember Max Gaines, EC Comics, they made all that money off the horror books in the 1950s, and then they started doing Mad Magazine as well. After the Comic Code Authority came along and destroyed their ability to distribute comic books in the United States, they found the loophole by producing a black and white magazine that wasn't governed under the Comic Code, was distributed through somewhat different channels, and they could get away with a lot more. By the 1960s, more people realized that you could do that EC-style horror in the same fashion as Mad was putting out their magazine. Warren was one of the main companies that did that. When Vampirella first came out, she was basically a cheesecake character, but she became legitimized when Archie Goodwin started writing it, because Archie Goodwin was a fan of the horror genre, and he brought a legitimacy, and he wrote serious stories with that character, and managed to hook a lot of readers. I think he also worked for them as an editor, and so he formed some very strong relationship with talent. Marvel hired him, and because of his relationship with talent, he was able to set up Marvel's boutique creator-owned line, Epic Comics, which began with Epic Illustrated, the magazine, where stuff like Metamorphosis Odyssey came out of, which one of these days we're going to have to cover on our independent comic books podcast,
The Underguides. A digging on the comic
Dreadstar. Yeah, I definitely want to do that.
Can you guys tell me any other epic books that y'all read? Any stuff that y'all liked from that line?
Charlie and Flytrap. I remember that
Arthur Zadam, sure.
Yeah, that was really good.
I don't think I read any of it.
I'm sure there's at least one book I could think of that we were just discussing earlier this evening.
Martial Law.
Martial Law was epic?
Yeah, Martial Law was epic.
No, I had no idea. I figured it was some whack British fucking there.
Well, and you got like artist. James de Matisse did a lot of stuff. Moonshadow.
Who printed Judge Dredd?
No, Judge Dredd was here, I think, Fleetway.
I am the law.
You had this boutique. It did okay. But when you're dealing with Marvel, it's just not the same scenario as when you're dealing with a company like First. For instance, Red Star left Epic.
Because Jim Starlin was
having trouble getting his checks. It's a creator-owned project. He was getting royalty checks as opposed to regular work for hire. Book this month, I'm going to go ahead and pay you now. He had to wait until royalty statements came in for him to get his money. And the checks started coming in later and later until finally Starlin said, fuck this. I'm going to move my enterprise to a whole other publisher and make my money there. There was an issue that Epic had a lot of times is that there was so much competition for talent. They wanted to do creator-owned projects and they didn't want to deal with a company like Marvel that they had trouble making money. Toward the late 80s, they started publishing mature readers' superhero works featuring Marvel characters. You remember the Havoc and Wolverine miniseries Meltdown?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, the Prestige.
Yeah, that was actually an Epic book. Same goes for Electro Assassin, which I'm sure you
read. Yeah, I've read that one. Yeah, Wilson Cabbage.
They were doing well. It was in the 1980s. Remember, you had those cutting edge books. Everybody wanted to be part of that new wave of sophisticated, darker mature, book. Darker titles. And Marvel was making some money by sending their characters off to Epic for a little bit and doing that type of material. But they didn't own anything. The creator-owned books, a lot of that money was having to go to the actual creators. And because they weren't necessarily getting the highest caliber, a lot of times people were breaking into the American industry or had been under the surface of that industry. They didn't have that name recognition value. Epic, trying to get their numbers up, trying to get a more stable fan base and have a fan base for the actual Epic Comics line, decided to create their own superhero groups. Most of it was created by Archie Goodwin again, and he came up with a series bible for what they called the Shadowline Saga. It was going to be three interconnecting books that had common themes. Two of the editors from the Epic Comics line, B.G. Chichester and Margaret Clark, would write the books based on the concepts generated by Archie Goodwin. And they had a whole group of fairly interesting artists that were going to work on these books. You just read Doctor Zero number one.
Yes, I did.
By D.G. Chichester and Margaret Clark on the writing front. Dennis Cowan drew it. Bill Sienkiewicz inked it.
Nice combo.
Cover date was April 1988. Tell me everything you can about Doctor Zero.
It's kind of confusing.
Who is Doctor Zero?
Well, I'm assuming he's one of the first superheroes to be coming out of this universe. He does this whole Mad Men scene where he's with all these advertising agents and they're talking about how the cigarette ad isn't really a cigarette ad. It's to see how people react to the man in the ski, tight-fitting uniform in the back. And
right, that vaguely resembles the costume that Dr. Zero would
have. Yeah, so I'm sitting there thinking, oh, this is going to be neat.
They're like product testing the superhero concept.
Yeah, and then he's doing the thing where he's wiping their minds out. So I'm thinking, okay, it's going to be kind of
so cool they don't either. Know what they've been working on.
Yeah.
Or they can't recall it.
And so that's where I thought it was going, but then it starts, he's a hero that but doesn't want to be seen. People are trying to draw him out.
Can you tell me what his powers are?
Well, I saw him shoot laser beams at one point out of his eyes. I'm assuming he flew also.
He obviously had mental powers if he's wiping people's minds.
Yeah, mental powers. Those are the three that I can remember from the book.
What's his backstory? How did he get his powers?
I don't think he went into it, did he?
What are his goals?
To cure the world of all evils. I remember that line. Because he saves some people, and a news reporter walks up to him, and they're like, you know, what's your name? What's your story? Who are you? And he's like, I'm Zero. And Zero, what does that mean? He's like, well, I guess zero tolerance of evil. So I'm Dr. Zero. And then right when they're about to get him, he flies away.
And that's the whole book, right?
Well, no, I mean, he's fighting a female villain, which I didn't quite understand where she came. Like, so I'm reading this, and I'm... The first part of the book starts with them. I guess he's a pilot, or there's something about pilots in Syria, and they're fighting as jet fighters. I was confused. Like, I wasn't sure what I was reading. It felt like an origin story, but...
You read one comic? This sounds like 15 comics.
Well, it felt like they were doing like 15 different stories in one book, but I wasn't sure what they were trying to get me to read.
You told
me not to read any of the stuff on the sides, which I wish I could have.
This was an experiment here. I wanted you to
read. Damn you, your experiments.
Yeah. I wanted you to read nothing but the actual comic material. None of the back matter, none of the editorial material, not the text of the inside cover of the book. Why don't you read that to our audience now? Or Illegal Machine can read
it. Yeah, I'll read it because I didn't read any of it.
Yes, please do read.
Epic Comics, The Shadow Line Saga, The Shadow Dwellers. They were almost human. Their evolution parallels ours, though they evolved swifter and a great deal better. But we evolved in greater numbers. far greater numbers. Individually, they were superior, but they were no match for the great tide of humankind that came in time to rule the earth. So they became a shadow race, living among us, speaking our languages, but secretly, eternally apart, sometimes as protectors, sometimes as predators. Over the centuries, they became the stuff of our legends and our myths, sometimes heroes, often monsters. But as the 20th century moved nearer and nearer its close, the world has shrunk to the point that there was little room for living in secret, and that the power of humankind has grown to doomsday proportions. There was a more pressing need than ever to emerge, to make themselves felt, to influence, to control the destiny of the planet they shared with us. Scattered over Earth, separated from each other by centuries of secrecy and hiding, torn by their own feuds and personal strife, the need to emerge was answered in ways as varied as the people of the shadows themselves varied. But it was answered. Cautiously, recklessly, with responsibility and without, they entered into the mainstream of human life. Sometimes heroes, often monsters.
Wasn't that Hancock the film? That pretty much sounded like Hancock.
Yeah, what I kept thinking about was Nightbreed.
No, that's Hancock, dude. They're a race that was among the humans, but they were fading away because if they're together, their powers start to fade, and if they're farther away, their powers kick back in.
Well, no, that's, you're taking that a little bit too literally. What they're basically saying is that these shadow dwellers have extraordinary superhuman powers of the like we normally see in costume characters in the comics, but they're supposed to be living in a real world scenario, but because Hancock, we were in a doomsday moment in the 1980s.
All that nuclear talk.
Yeah, that's what all that pileup was, is because of all the tensions between the East and the West and the nuclear stockpiles and all the shit that Reagan was talking back in the day. There was a real sense that we were all going to die in a nuclear winter. You remember those days,
yes,
don't you?
Yes.
The 80s were full of
these. I dated myself, yes, but yes. That, what Mac just read, should have been the first comic.
And instead, you're reading a book that's mostly gibberish and you don't even know who the character is and what he can do and why he's doing what he's doing.
And I rarely do this in books, but I would read two pages and go back two pages because I wasn't sure where it was taking me.
You took a long time to read that one comic book.
And it's really not that dense of a book. It's just, like he said, it felt like 15 different stories. And without that intro, I really did feel lost. I didn't understand what was going on.
Didn't it read like a lot of the higher end 80s stuff like Frank Miller and Alan Moore, but without any of that quality, that talent? It's inept, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
It wanted to be those things, but it didn't have the technical skills.
I felt like if you did two issues of that intro, and then I read this book as a third part, oh, wow. Wow, that's great. If I was to walk in cold like that, because usually I don't read the side stuff, I would have never picked up that book again.
The editor-in-chief of Epic Comics, who answers directly to the editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics, Jim Shooter, he created all those concepts. His two main editors at Epic are the guys who are writing it. And the person who's actually supposed to be editing the book, this associate editor, is below all those people. His bosses are writing the book, and he's supposed to try to edit his bosses. Does that sound like a good idea?
Good luck with that.
Remember how Image was, where they would hire these guys who were supposed to be editors? But these were artists that were so full of themselves, they thought they were going to write their own books. They're going to hire everybody to produce the books. And then there's the expectation that the editors are going to tell them no with anything, or tell them that they did something wrong and to fix something. You've got this neuter boy editor who can't explain that your story doesn't make sense to anybody who doesn't know this entire lore, this entire Bible of stories. And there were two other series in this. They made a point of saying, well, you don't have to read all three series. You can read one and you'll see hints of what's going on in the greater universe, but you'll be able to understand each story on its own. That's a bunch of bullshit, huh?
Yeah, no. I was lost from my go.
There's a book I picked up at Half Price Books. I recommend it if you can catch a copy. It's called The Slings and Arrows Comic Guide, A Critical Assessment, now with over 5,000 titles from the 1930s onward. I'm going to read their synopsis of Dr. Zero. It's only one paragraph. One of the three linked titles, see Powerline and St. George, set in a world like ours, except for the existence of a second superpowered race of shadow people who have been manipulating human society since the beginning of civilization. Dr. Zero, the oldest and most powerful of the shadows, fears mankind is out of control and thus instigates a cynical contingency agenda involving him becoming a superhero, quote-unquote, and saving the world for himself. Created by Archie Goodwin and initially illustrated by Dennis Cowan, the work is sadly ruined by heavy-handed scripts from Margaret Clark and Dan Chichester. The storylines were concluded in critical mass. That paragraph has more information than the entire fucking comic book you just read. Okay, let's check out Powerline. Lenore and Victor share an energy field that allows them to fly, to project a force shield, and potentially far more. They have an adult guardian in Vic's uncle, Tyler Ripley, who has a metallic hand and wears a jacket with Ripper emblazoned across its shoulders. There's a whole previous generation of supernatural beings referred to as shadows that all three appear to be related to. Being young, beautiful, and traumatized by the recent deaths of their parents, it's unsurprising that Rick and Lenore are also gradually falling in love. Written by Dan Chichester and Margaret Clark, in an engaging but not very helpfully structured style, the initial artwork is by Dave Ross before Greg Morrow comes aboard with four, giving the characters some human scale and actual expressions. Without the related titles referred to, this series makes little sense.
In your face! I have a question for you, Frank. We're reading this because...
We'll get to that.
Because right now I feel like I'm actually in that comic book.
St. George. Troubled priest Michael Devlin is recruited by a mysterious sect to combat monsters that threaten civilization. Unaware that he is merely the latest pawn in a protracted civil war between rival shadow dwellers. Despite a good plot and cast, plus strong art from Klaus Janson, Dan Spiegel, and Jim Lee, the pretentious ponderings of writers Dan Chichester and Margaret Clark on the nature of evil act as an almost irresistible soporific.
Soporific.
Ooh, they're just getting punished.
Right, right.
Wow.
I've read this entire Dr. Zero series, and it was a serious fucking chore. Let's pass these around. You looked at number one already, right, Matt?
Yeah.
What'd you think of the art on that one?
Gorgeous.
Are y'all familiar with Dennis Cowan?
Yeah. Dennis Cowan plus Bill Sienkiewicz is almost Mark Teixeira.
It looks a hell of a lot like Bill Sienkiewicz when he's on his A game. Really good looking stuff.
So, hey, perspective.
Here's number two.
They have similar styles. Cowan and Sienkiewicz have similar.
So, really grimy, yeah, but Cowan, dirty, Cowan,
earth
yeah.
level artist.
Cowan was a guy who I enjoyed him a lot on books like Steel. He was great on Hardware, but he was never able to penetrate commercially the way that Sienkiewicz was.
Sienkiewicz had the covers.
Sienkiewicz was a person who was bringing a new art style into comics, where Cowan went from being a much more mainstream style of artist to adopting qualities of Sienkiewicz, but they were a great combination.
Would you say this was a cool premise?
Yeah, I think it is. Dr. Zero, by the way, the main things that he could do, if I recall correctly, he could fly, he had telepathy, he could communicate with porpoise. I don't know if they're comparable or superior to humans. I don't think they ever really spelled that out. And he created what he called, if I remember correctly, the Zero Effect, where he could create a vacuum in his general area and cause things to implode on themselves. In the first issue, they don't even get that part across.
No. And I can tell you, what you're telling me, I see so much potential that I would be like, man, that sounds like a really cool stuff. You have a hero who's not really a hero, but he's pretending to be a hero to manipulate the world type. I mean, that's cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've seen that in Thunderbolts and stuff, but when this was coming out, that was pretty much a new concept, wasn't it?
His fame. That was kind of the 80s, right? The deconstruction of the hero.
Sure.
But that sounds cool. That first thing I read, dude, it did not lead me in any way toward that thought line.
You guys trade issues? Because one of you was looking at two and one was looking at three. Still a great looking book, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And see, you've got, well, who did that cover? Was that Kent Williams on number two?
Awesome. Yeah, this cover's awesome.
Yeah, that Kevin Nolan one? Yeah. Kevin Nolan painted art is usually for the win.
I remember the St. George advertisement. I remember seeing it.
Yeah.
John J. Muth.
John J. Muth did that cover, yeah. Oh. Yeah, well, one of the things they had
Alien
going.
Alien Legion was there too?
Yeah, Alien Legion was an epic title, sure. All the first issues for the three books were by the same artist, Bill Sienkiewicz. Yeah. Very interesting. All three of those covers were great. The second were all John J. Muth. The third were all Kevin Nolan's. It gave them a strong linkage there. Mm. Although supposedly you were supposed to be able to read them individually. But trust me, I read all eight issues of Dr. Zero. You needed other titles to understand what the fuck was going on. For instance, in one issue, they introduced the character Shrek, who was later ported over to the Marvel Universe as Terror. You remember that character?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Tell us about Terror, Inc.
Terror, wasn't he like some kind of deformed demon-looking creature that wore
Yeah, the green guy with the spikes that shot
his
him.
His eye had one eye that was really wide open, the other one different colors.
You remember what his power was?
No, I don't remember his power.
He was a mercenary, but
he could cut him into pieces, right, or something.
What would happen is he could absorb the body parts of other people. That's so if somebody else died, he could pluck their eyes out and put one of their eyes in his place, and he'd be able to see things that they had seen recently. He had one of his arms ripped off. As long as he ripped the arm off of another guy, he could plug it into himself and take it as his own.
Marvel, bring this character back.
It was a cool idea, right?
That is a cool idea.
Yeah,
that would be a really fucked up hero.
This was one little subline universe. Can you think of another one like that in Marvel from around the same time period?
Well, I was asking you earlier about like a Star Brand.
To celebrate the 25th anniversary of Marvel Comics, Jim Shooter decided that he wanted to do, I guess it was 1986, 1987.
New Generation or New World?
New Universe.
New Universe, that's what.
He always did those big editorials where he's, yeah, the Stan Lee and Kirby comics were more realistic, but you lift up a building and it's got a flat bottom. So he wanted people to, if they lifted up the building, you'd see all the plumbing and the building would start to crumble underneath them because the physics would allow the structure to remain intact under those circumstances. He wanted to do this much more realistic universe. He was trying to get that launched at a time where his personal stock in Marvel was plummeting. He was reviled by the talent because he would enforce edicts that came down from upper management, and they were going for one owner after another owner. And I believe at this point they were owned by New World Pictures. And I don't recall if somebody was trying to set up the sale to New World Pictures or New World was trying to set up the sale to somebody else. But they were doing everything they could to cut down on the costs and raise the profitability of Marvel to make it look as good as possible and then sell that for a profit. As much as Jim Shooter was willing to work with management to make Marvel a major profitable company, he had some scruples and these guys apparently had none. From one conflict to another, ultimately he was shown the door, and I mean like security had to take him out with a box from what I understand and throw him out of the Marvel offices. But when he was trying to get the new universe off the ground, originally he had a nice big budget and he was going to get some good people to work on this. He managed to talk John Romita Jr. into leaving X-Men to do Star Brand, for instance, with him as a writer. Most of the development Solomon was handed over to Tom DeFalco, who was one of the main lieutenants of Jim Shooter. The budget kept shrinking, and DeFalco kept not getting stuff done. Eventually, the new universe actually came out. And as you recall, the new universe was largely shit. It was full of old veteran hacks that were willing to work for nothing, new guys that had never really done much of anything, and editor buddies of Shooter's who was basically doing them a favor by writing those books, including one Archie Goodwin. So Goodwin had tried to make Jim Shooter's vision of a new universe work, and then having failed that, he goes over and does the Shadow Line, where it's his vision of a new universe. But he has to hand off the actual creative chores to these two editors, who sucked at writing at this point in time, who were not capable of executing the degree of, what's the word I'm looking for?
Complexity.
Yeah, it's just, it was too complex for them. They didn't have the skills to pull off what he wanted to do. They're talking, like, when you're reading the book, it's supposed to be very topical and very realistic, but this first story arc you're looking at that ran through the first three issues, he essentially runs into a Lex Luthor-type character who's working with the U.S. government trying to create a nuclear bomb. When they were testing the hydrogen bomb, the atomic bomb, whichever, mm-hmm. there was concern that they would detonate this thing and it would actually catch the atmosphere on fire.
Yeah.
And this scientist in this story had figured out how to do that. So that's what he was going to do, and that's who Dr. Zero was having to stop from destroying the world. They don't explain his motivation, and ultimately what happens is Dr. Zero lobotomizes him through telepathy and makes him sell chili dogs at a restaurant in the South. It's nastier than Reed Richards turning a bunch of scrolls into cows,
yeah.
but it's
that's
not,
exactly
he's a guy who's a murderer though, so he's not really that bad of a guy. The worst thing he did is there's a rah-rah general that he also did something similar to make sure that the world didn't blow up. But that's, I would think, an acceptable loss.
Well, they talk about people dying, collateral damage, and some kind of bombing drop. In the first that issue I read,
right?
I can tell you, it's I'm now that you're telling me this, I'm able to piece some of the story now mm-hmm. together. But there's still parts of the blocks that are make no sense. Where did this character come from? So as you're explaining things, I'm putting the story together in my head, what I've just read. So.
But you see, what you have to do is either have somebody who's read the entire series and go back from the future to the past, explain to you what the fuck was supposed to be happening in those early books, and supplemental materials like this book that we were reading out of.
Yeah.
Pretty terribly executed. But Dr. Zero, it sounds like an interesting premise, this villainous character who's basically saving the world for himself, but he's saving it from people that are so much worse than him that he's not even an anti-hero. He's just an asshole. But otherwise, he's not a villain, though. He's not really gray when you're saving the world from being exploded.
Well, you're doing it for yourself, though. He's not really doing it for you. He's doing it for himself.
But do you care about the motivation of the world getting saved anyway?
The greater good, I guess. Oh, yeah, they did mention the Red Scare and the Gipper. Nightbreed and Hellraiser, were those also on their epic?
Yeah, actually. All that Clive Barker stuff was, and not only that, but one of the co-writers of the Shadowline saga, D.G. Chichester, was one of the main people who got the license in the first place and was editor of the books once they had the license.
You can actually own a lot of that stuff, too.
Yeah, well, that's why I was saying Nightbreed, is I kind of wonder if Clive Barker didn't influence how these books were being written.
I could see, because then... Well, yeah. That's a series I would love to see collected in a trade.
Some of this stuff has been collected. Checker Comics did some collections a number of years back, and I believe that Boom Studios has the rights now and have done some reprints of the Epic material.
Really? I'd like to read it.
Let's continue on to issues 4 and 5.
Very upset to see the artist change in issue number 5. Was that permanent change?
Issue number 4 is the last one with Cowan Sienkiewicz. Dark story. And this one, a fellow Shadow, who was apparently one of the death gods in ancient Egypt, been plaguing mankind for years. Well, they were working on a super plague to unleash it. The Soviets shut it down because of the manipulations of Dr. Zero. But the guy goes nuts and scoops up the disease he's concocted. He starts rubbing into people's faces and infecting everybody. He's making this trail through the Soviet wilderness trying to infect as many people as possible and get to a major population center. Dr. Zero and his friend, who's a KGB agent, are off to stop him. Dumb story, but it's drawn so well you don't care. It's really good looking.
Yeah, it's really kinetic, man. There's so much stuff moving around in those towns.
Dig the Dr. Zero cover by Mark Chiarello on the 4th issue. It has that propagandistic quality to it. It's like simplistic, intentionally, it has that iconic quality. And then with the 5th issue, you've got Kevin O'Neill on the cover art of Martial Law fame.
Yep.
In this story, there's a creature called the Ifrit, who's essentially an evil genie who's another shadow, who is trying to get himself launched on an SDI satellite so that he can fire on Earth from space without being destroyed when the Earth, he assumes, is going to be destroyed inevitably. So he's getting off the planet, and he has a laser to shoot back at Earth. Dr. Zero takes great pains to stop him, and he teams up with the character Shrek / Terror to put an end to the Ifrit. Unfortunately, this issue was drawn by Brett Ewins and Steve Dillon. I don't know about you, Yeah, Steve Dillon was an inker back in the day on occasion.
Really?
The art in this book is so much less appealing than in the previous four issues. This was my stopping point. It took me a day or so to try to read this book again because I had to power through this issue. Because everything that was failing on this book failed so much harder without pretty art to help cover it.
Jansen, issue 6 cover, very nice.
Miles Jansen drew St. George too, and I believe he stayed for most of the series. I think he was one of the only guys who stayed on for the majority of the series, and I believe he left the Punisher to do this, or he was canned off the Punisher, I'm not sure which.
How many total issues is this from?
8 wonderful issues.
There are definitely comic book things going on in this comic book. Ah, there's an ass crack. It's definitely an adult book. I saw an ass crack.
But surprisingly, no full nudity and no cursing, so it's not even mature readers superhero comics.
Did they plan to end it with 8 issues, or was it just sales were that bad? It was like, all right, it's time to wrap it up.
We'll get to that.
I never read this one. Was that any good?
Which
the
one?
Last American?
I never read it. I always saw the ads. It looked so much like Martial Law. You know it's not going to be Martial Law. Yeah.
Well, I've always seen it and always looked interesting, but I just never got a chance to read it.
So what's going on here in these last three issues?
Issues 6 and 7, the art switches to one Dan Spiegel, who is an acquired taste, we'll say.
Yes.
He was one of those guys who got work in the 70s especially, who drew in a realistic style, but it was more like a newspaper strip style, I would say. More like, like one of those serious strips. So he's one of those guys who clearly did not enjoy drawing superheroes. Because when he has to draw Dr. Zero in full costume, which isn't very often in the story, he draws him looking like a Kurt Swan character. And everybody else has this heavy cross-hatching, and they're drawing this very realistic style. And all of a sudden, this Kurt Swan character just bursts into the midst of it and is completely out of place. But they contrive a circumstance where he gets rid of his cape and his mask, so he's basically just a guy running around in white shirt and gloves punching people. One thing they did is that Dr. Zero is supposed to be, they hint in these stories that he predates humanity, that he can remember evolving, coming up from the muck and becoming a human being over the course of millennia. He's extraordinarily powerful. He's the most powerful of the shadows that we are allowed to know about. But what they do is in the second issue, when he confronts the guy who's trying to blow up the earth, he gets hit by this energy that screws up his powers. So for the entire rest of the series, he's working at diminished power levels and struggling with that. Why would you go to the trouble of creating a super powerful character and then depower them in the second or third issue of the series? Of course, it also involves him being left for dead in the Arctic waters and rescued by the porpoise.
I saw the porpoise. Porpoise?
I believe they're porpoises.
I saw the porpoises rescued.
The porpoises created an army who attracted the attention of killer whales.
I didn't say that because that's assumed.
So the porpoises are rushing toward a submarine that Dr. Zero has been trapped in by these U.S. government black ops operatives called the Merchants, who are trying to capture him so that he can become an agent of the U.S. government. And so the porpoise lead the whales to the submarine, and then they divert so that the whales slam into the submarine and knock it about. And that's how Dr. Zero gets saved, not through his own incredible powers, considering that he's, even at diminished power level, should be well powerful enough to fight some guys with some guns. He has to bring in his fishy friends to do it for him.
Aquaman style.
Yeah, that's, who thought that was a good idea? I'm hoping I'm not projecting as a Martian Manhunter fan, but a lot of his powers are very Martian Manhunter-y, and they're always coming up with these stupid little things, like he gets infected with a disease in the fourth issue, and he gets zapped with this gadget by the scientist in the second issue, where these guys manage to come up with just the thing that you need to combat his awesome abilities, so that he becomes a wimp, because there aren't any super villains floating around for him to fight, and when they do come up with them, they're awful, like the Ifrit character. It's one of those instances where you've got people who just aren't good at writing the type of material they're trying to write and failing spectacularly.
Talking about that, I'm thinking of Vandal Savage type of character.
He should be really cool. He should be really interesting.
He should have been very, very arrogant about his existence.
Yes. It hurt me to read through these 8 issues.
I see the pain in your eyes.
And I hated it so much that I made a point of reading the letters columns, because I expected at least one person would write at least one letter pointing out that the creators of the book were incompetent, that the book was aimless and incomprehensible without being read by the other two titles. And instead, the letter columns were full of nothing but praise. So my assumption that the only people who stuck around and bothered to write letters were assholes, this book is like Justin Bieber's face. Reading it, I just want to punch everybody involved with it. I, by extension, even hated the letter hacks who wrote letters to this book, because I read them expecting some sort of constructive criticism, something that resembles something realistic. And instead, the guys who are praising the books, it's still half-hearted praise, and it's these guys who seem to be buying in the pretension of the book without actually enjoying the book. And they keep talking about how interesting an idea it is that Dr. Zero is a villain who's pretending to be a hero, but he doesn't do anything villainous in 7 of the 8 issues. He's just the superheroic character with a bit of an attitude, sort of a submariner type. He doesn't do anything bad or wrong. So what the fuck are they talking about, and what's so interesting about this?
You think they're real letters?
I think they're real letters. I think they were just selective about what they were doing.
Obviously, they're selective about selective.
But another thing that was interesting is I read the editorial content, and that was another instance, because the main guy who was editing this stuff was Steve Buscaletto. He has a rating tone in the editorial materials. Even he's pissing me off. The associate editor is pissing me off. In, I believe, the 7th issue, he's promising that the 9th issue of Dr. Zero would introduce a new art team. Kevin O'Neill was going to be drawing the book. It was taking so long to paint Martial Law that so that he could keep collecting a check, he was going to draw Dr. Zero while working on future Martial Law projects. They announced follow-up 6-issue miniseries after the end of the Fear and Loathing story arc. Mm-hmm. And he was going to work on that in his side time while being the artist on Dr. Zero. Issue number 9 never came out, even though in issue 7 they're talking about the publishing plans and they're talking about how the 3 books were going to do the big crossover with the 9th issues called Critical Mass. But all the fucking books got canceled the very next month. Nobody seemed to have any advance notice on this thing.
It seemed to end abruptly.
All of them have final issue on the cover itself, just to let you know. I've got the numbers from Capital City Comics Distribution, who are one of the biggest, if not the biggest, comic distributor to comic shops in the United States.
Let's go by the numbers.
Dr. Zero, number 1, sold 22,400 copies through Capital City. Let's be really kind and let's triple that number. To take into account Diamond and the other distributors that were around at the time, Heroes World, that lot, that's still only 66,000 copies. This is at a time when Marvel was canceling books that weren't selling 125. That's the first issue. By the 3rd issue, Capital City was only selling 14,900 copies.
Ooh.
And by issue 8, 7,100 copies.
Ooh.
So again, triple that. That's maybe 21,000 copies. We cancel books today that are selling 21,000 copies. These books just fucking crashed. The Critical Mass miniseries, it was a 7-issue prestige format miniseries, square bound. I believe what they did is they took all the material they had left over from produced issues of the Shadowline Saga, and they just turned it into a miniseries so they could use that material and wrap up the story arcs.
You think I could buy Dr. Zero?
Character Dr. Zero?
Yeah.
No.
You don't think I could just find whoever the fuck has Dr. Zero and be like, you know what?
Wait, no. Marvel still owns Dr. Zero.
I know. You think anybody... Well, I guess now they're probably getting off on turning shitty characters into good characters.
Oh, yeah. He's coming back, dude. I'm sure he's coming back.
Their head's going to get so big, they're going to start releasing, like, softcore porn movies, and they're going to use these really shitty old characters. Marvel Entertainment presents...
You're talking about getting name brand creators to work on the character. How's Alex Ross, for instance?
Yeah.
No, I'm seriously. Alex Ross most recently painted Dr. Zero.
Really?
For real?
Yeah. Into a wraparound promotional image. I don't know if it's going to end up being a cover or just a poster or whatever for Secret Wars 2015. Yeah. But before we get into that, let me cover.
Is why I can't buy Dr. Zero. What about Saint? What's this fuck?
We'll come back to that. Let me go ahead and read you what Slings and Arrows Guide says about Critical Mass, a Shadowline Saga, 7 issues. This square-bound series concludes the plots from Epic's canceled superhero titles Dr. Zero, Powerline, and St. George in fine fashion. Good plots from Dan Chichester and Margaret Clark are allied to decent artwork from the likes of Ray Morrow, Kev O'Neill, Jorge Zaffino, and pre-image and appallingly colored Jim Lee. The thread running through 2 stories per issue is the coming apocalypse organized by Henry Clark, who's that Lex Luthor motherfucker I've been talking about before, who's so grateful for the restoration of his memory that he intends to set off nuclear explosions across USA as thanks. As he plans, Dr. Zero continues to manipulate everyone. The Order of St. George wants Zero brought down, and Powerline need him as an ally.
Well, that was an interesting synopsis.
Marvel obviously owns a lot of properties that nobody's done anything with, and they made a point. Neil Gaiman, when Neil Gaiman came into the company and did 1602, Marvel started pushing this numerical values for all their alternate universes, like all the what-ifs and shit. They all got their own numbers. That's when the Marvel 616 at the core Marvel universe got popularized.
I think so.
Today, Marvel has a multiverse, and DC has a multiverse, and they're both playing around with that concept a lot these days. Marvel bought Malibu. You remember the Ultraverse?
With the Badger?
Ultraverse was Prime.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Hardcase, and Prototype, all those characters.
Yeah.
All those properties are at least partially owned by their creators, and there's a bunch of other political stuff that prevents Marvel from wanting to do anything with those characters. So they've been sidelined. But Jonathan Hickman, who's been working on the Avengers books for a while, has been pushing incursions where characters from different multiverses are coming into the Marvel Universe. The new Avengers, the Illuminati characters like Black Panther, Doctor Strange, Mr. Fantastic, Black Bolt. The Marvel multiverse is apparently colliding with parts of itself. When two worlds converge on one another, one of them either destroys the other world or they both blow up.
I think I read a little bit of that. Yeah.
My main exposure to it was I read the first New Avengers arc that Hickman wrote with the Illuminati characters. These Marvel heroes, who are some of the more gray heroes at this point because they're playing at such big stakes that the entire universe is living and dying, they're having to deal with other forces that are intentionally destroying different Marvel multiverses to prevent them from incurring on one another and destroying each other without their manipulation so that they don't get to choose who lives and who dies. Big cosmic stakes. Well, in the midst of doing that, Kirkman has been mining all these little leftover Marvel universes that nobody's been able to do anything with. You remember back in the early 2000s, they gave the new universe to Warren Ellis for the new Universal miniseries.
Yeah, I've read the trade,
where he reimagined all those 80s concepts as much more dark and cynical because it's Warren Ellis, he can't do anything else. It didn't hit big enough. They did a few spinoff specials, and then they just dropped the new Universal thing. Where Hickman's like, oh, great, that means I get two universes. I've got the new universe of the 80s and the new universe of the aughts, and they're both valid now. He's also decided to mine the Shadowline saga. So Alex Ross has painted Dr. Zero into a prominent image of the first Secret Wars promotional artwork. The interiors are going to be painted by Esad Ribic. They've got Battleworld, which my understanding is they're going to take a number of Marvel alternate timelines and put them all under this one world in different continents. So you've got Days of Future Past has its own country. Armor Wars, I believe, has its own country. Future Imperfect has its own country. And all these... That Maestro, though. And all these alternate universes are going to fight each other, and it'll have repercussions throughout the greater Marvel Universe. My understanding is also that Secret Wars is going to cause the suspension and cancellation of all the Marvel titles at certain points, and then they're going to do Secret Wars, and then they're going to come back out of that with a new and radically altered Marvel Universe. They will probably incorporate characters like the ones from the Shadowline saga.
Whoa.
That's so cool. I mean, I got it.
Mind blown. It sounds really cool. I'm just scared it's going to be like what Jeff Johns did with Green Lantern, where they had this great idea and it just got bigger and bigger. Or better yet, when Grant Morrison was doing the 52, and it sounded cool, but it just got bigger.
It's like where,
and bigger,
where,
and it lost its shape.
Where they have a start, but they haven't really thought of the middle and end yet.
Mm-hmm.
It ramps up too quickly, and suddenly you've got this huge project that's way out of control and too
many. And it doesn't make sense. It's all going in different directions.
And now you got to get all these people to try and fucking come up with an ending, and it all just turns to shit.
Even setting all that aside, because Hickman's been building on this for the last several years across multiple Avengers titles, and he's brought back the Beyonder and a lot of stuff related to Secret Wars. He's spent a lot of time figuring out what he's going to do in his book, but a lot of people are afraid that Marvel might be pulling a new 52 on itself, God help us, and trying to do Crisis on Infinite Earths for Marvel, where they're going to have a new Marvel universe coming out of this. Fix all the things that didn't quite work or were broken. It's one thing when you've got one creator on a series of titles holding that shit down, but whenever you go line wide, trying to get everybody having the same mindset as far as what they're going to do with the universe after that point, it's frightening. It's interesting to me that Dr. Zero is such a central figure in the opening imagery to Secret War, and this is from a failed new universe. And there are other new universe characters tied to this as well. The fear is we're going to get a Marvel universe that's getting broken by all these other failed universes dragging it down into the mire with them.
So why don't they just leave the core Marvel Universe alone, and you make it about the Ultimate Universe and this universe and all the other universes, and just play with that.
But to give
the
people a reason
core, yeah,
to
read it, I guess. Leave the core titles alone for the collectors, for the people who've invested. You still have your books, but then if you want to read this cool thing we're doing on the side, I'm tired of jacking with the main books.
As a DC guy, having gone through this with DC multiple times now to the point where they finally shook my ass off after all these years, I would hate to see that happen to Marvel, but I think Marvel's smart enough to realize they have to keep all their continuity. They can't throw it out the window like they did with DC Comics. But it wouldn't shock me if you had a soft reboot where they cleaned up stuff like Brand New Day with the Spider-Man titles, where they decided that they didn't want the mess of Mary Jane Watson, so they managed to consciously uncouple Peter Parker and Mary Jane and rewrite some of Spider-Man's backstory so that people who had died previously were back alive again, and give them a fresh start from some of the mess that had been made of that character, which isn't necessarily something I would say is a good idea. It's not necessarily the way to go. But Marvel's running around breaking their toys right now, and it'd be an easy fix to drop a few things that they are less than proud of. Maybe throw out a lot of new number one so that they get the kind of huge influx of new readers that DC got temporarily with the new 52 without actually sacrificing the old readers like what happened with DC's new 52.
I'm thinking of the problem where Spider-Man revealed his secret identity and he became the...
Right, Civil War.
Yeah,
where, Civil War. Where he had the Iron Spider or something,
Something like that. And then at the end, they're like, well, how do you cure it? Oh, Doctor Strange did magic and he just wiped everybody's memory. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking, God, that's so shitty.
Such a cheat. Did that happen in the actual Civil War? I don't remember that happening in the actual
War. I want to say it happened in Spider-Man. I just remember reading that.
It must have.
I think that's pretty much where I stopped reading Spider-Man.
What is Straczynski still doing in the book at that point?
I think so.
So he was on Vapors at that point,
clearly. And like I said... Oh, dude, he's been on Vapors for a while.
Well, he left the book not too long after Civil War, didn't he? Because he left with the breaking up Mary Jane and Peter.
I didn't touch a Spider-Man book until someone threw. Well, you mentioned it to me, the Superior Spider-Man.
Yeah.
You kept talking about it. I'm like, let me give it a try. And I read the first issue. This is interesting. And I read the first few books. I really liked this. And then I went back and looked for all that Dan Slott had wrote. And I enjoyed his Spider-Man. For me, as a fan, I enjoyed it. That's what I'm scared. Marvel's going to go back and try to fix all this. I don't know.
Don't fix something that isn't really broken. DC, the DC universe is really fucking
broken. That's why I don't read any DC books. Yeah. I don't understand. If I go to Third Planet or Bedrock. I go to Bedrock and I look on the shelves and I'm looking at these DC books and I don't understand any of them. If you're out of the loop for a year, forget about it.
I don't think Marvel is that dumb. One of the reasons why DC Comics happened in the way they did is because Jim Shooter was such a polarizing figure that a lot of people left or were pushed out of Marvel when he was editor-in-chief. And so they went over to the competition and some of them did some of the best work of their careers. This time, DC has become such a toxic environment that they don't have very many grade-A creators anymore. That's one of the reasons why New 52 was such a failure ultimately, because they didn't have the talent to back up their grand schemes. I think Marvel recognizes that the universe works, that there might be some things that they want to tweak. But you can definitely ignite a lot of passion and interest by threatening to do something like what they've done at DC. Certainly, if you have a line-wide renumbering, not necessarily a reboot, but here's X number of number one titles by some top-tier creators. Come jump into the Marvel Universe now if you haven't done it before. I can see that being a smart move on Marvel's part. Just so long as it doesn't
devolve into someone's time. Look, I think we all kind of talked. The concept behind Dr. Zero isn't bad.
No, it's actually
cool. This is a good opportunity to say, hey, you know what? Let's take a bunch of these characters, introduce them all at once, and if two or three stick, then we keep them.
I would really like to see Terror back.
That's a cool concept. And he popped up in a number of places. People like that idea. That's why David Latham did a Max series featuring Terror. Two of them, in fact. You gave me the first issue of it, not more of it. Yeah, it was good. It was cool. I want to check out more of it. Doctor Zero number 8, the very final issue. I don't know if I showed this to you guys yet. Okay. Now, that one was written by Chuck Dixon and drawn by Gary Kulpiece, a guy he worked with quite often. I think they're friends, personal friends. They did Moon Knight together as well and Punisher. That one issue tells the story of a shadow that had been mentally lobotomized by Dr. Zero in barbarian times. And this guy's had to live for untold centuries as mentally incapacitated. A chance meeting with Dr. Zero in New York many years later helps him to recalibrate his mind and he becomes the person he used to be. They have a great big fight in the middle of New York City. It's revealed that the reason why Dr. Zero had mind wiped this guy, he was supposed to have been up to something that Zero didn't like. He was a benevolent leader trying to help humanity to improve themselves and to get away from barbarism. He was one of the good guys, but Dr. Zero wanted to keep mankind in the muck and the mire. He talks about us like we're low dogs. Shadow shouldn't even be talking to humans. Finally, in this last issue of this book, written by a writer who actually knows how to write correctly, you see that Dr. Zero is not a good guy. He's not somebody you can root for. He's somebody who can sometimes come to good ends, but his motivations are so tainted, so prejudiced, that you know this guy is going to be a problem. Ultimately, he's going to work against our good. He might very well want to see us all dead if it means that the shadows get to retake the earth. All of a sudden, this character becomes much more controversial and much more interesting. If you integrate a character like that into the Marvel Universe, you could definitely go places with him. And I wonder, people are very hesitant to create new characters for Marvel or DC anymore. Because if you've got a good idea, why don't you go and sell that yourself through a company like Boom or Image or Dark Horse? Make your own movie, make your own money. It almost makes me wonder if at this point Marvel and DC are so desperate for new concepts, they're willing to go back to the 80s and pull up the interesting aspects of characters like New Universe and Shadowline to reinvigorate their universe. They don't have any new characters that are right in the World of Fire. Miss Marvel being something of an exception since she was a surprise hit. Maybe that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get a whole bunch of new characters into their universe.
There's any maybe about that.
Going to Secret Wars is nice to have a little primer on some of these bizarro side universes. They're becoming part of the Marvel universe, apparently. Here's your first shot.
Interesting concepts all around. We'll see if the execution fails like it did when Shadowline saga.
I'd like to see what current writers could do with these characters.
Somebody like Jonathan Hickman could probably have a field day with a guy like Dr. Zero.
Dr. Zero sounds very interesting.
And St. George isn't bad either.
The concepts behind them are cool. If handled
correctly.
It's
kind of Highlander-ish. They're, secret society.
Well, actually, the funny thing is,
of people who are more powerful.
Yeah, but the powers.
I know that's true.
Well, I was going to say, powers they have an issue with Walker. I guess he remembers his past where he was literally a walking monkey. And then him and another monkey both had powers. And they evolved from those powers. I think it was an issue with, like, no dialogue. Someone probably won't call me out on that shit, but I distinctly remember that issue. Hearing this, that concept has been around a while. Some people can pull it off, and it works good in their books. They just didn't pull it off.
Well, and you look at St. George. St. George is to Dr. Zero as Angela was to Spawn, where you get these people who get these superpowered armors, and they're dragon slayers in modern era. They're here to kill the shadows that get out of control. The latest one is a priest, and he's after Dr. Zero, but what he doesn't realize is that he's not working for divine purposes. He's actually working for a demonic shadow who's just trying to rein in these people that get out of hand. Powerline was about these kids who don't have great powers separated, but together they can become powerful enough to potentially challenge Dr. Zero, but because they're young, they don't know what they're doing with it. They're prone to influences. There's a lot you could do with those ideas. It would be cool to see some of that stuff integrated in the Marvel Universe. If you've got this intellectual property that's lying fallow, even if you don't have any fans, let's face it, 7,000 people were buying these final issues of this book, but the concepts are still ripe for picking. So,
well, take advantage of that. Shit, remember Dr. Zero? I'm like, yeah, I kind of do remember Dr. Zero. You know what I mean? Like, I remember seeing those in long boxes for 25 cents that I never bought. But at least something is there, right? You're going to hearken to something that somebody remembers digging through in a long box or seeing on it. So there's nothing wrong with that either. Now, if like you would have sold 100,000 copies of this book, it was freaking terrible. That probably would work against you.
Yeah, that's part of the taint of the new universe.
So who cares, right?
Yeah, that's part of the taint of the new universe because enough people bought New Universe to know how bad a lot of the new universe was. Hey, I like New Universe too. I'm a defender of those books, but I also bought most of those copies out of quarter boxes in the late 80s. I wasn't willing to pay 75 cents for those books. But these are almost completely new to most people. Hardly anybody read these books. It was funny because I was listening to the Who's Who podcast recently, and they're talking the Wanderers miniseries, and Shag was saying how he couldn't even find that book in the quarter bins. They were so uncommon. Went to mycomicshop.com and looked it up. You can buy any of those Wanderers issues easily for $1.10. But if you decide you want to read Critical Mass, especially with guys like Kev O'Neill drawing Dr. Zero, they have two or three of the seven issues. Those books are so uncommon, so rare, that even one of the largest comic shops in the world can't provide them to you.
Mm.
Yeah, that's pretty damned obscure. Let's say these books take off. Like, let's say the concepts take off and you try to go back and buy these books. There's so few of them out there. Good fucking luck, dude.
Now you got me looking for these damn Terror Inc. Max books. I want to read them. I mean, that's a fucking awesome cover.
Well, you know, I actually bought Terror Inc. when it first came out back in the 90s. I think I bought the first three or four issues because that was back when I was ordering for previews and I would get stuck with this shit that I'd pre-ordered. It had art by this fellow, Jorge Safino. And he's another one of those guys like Bill Sienkiewicz where me, as a reader, I was not prepared for the kind of shit he was doing. And I fucking hated the artwork. I just... despise it. Now I can look back on it and appreciate how daring and how unique his visual sense was. But at the time, there's like, what the fuck is this nasty looking gnarly fucking shit? I bet you if we read it today, it'd be pretty good. And V.G. Chichester went on to write a well-respected run Daredevil. Mm-hmm. He's the one who wrote The Fall of the Kingpin, which is one of my favorite post-Miller, post-Innocenti stories in Daredevil. He did some good stuff, and he went on to write a lot of those Hellraiser books, and
that's the thing. I have the Pinhead series, and I reread them not too long ago, and they hold up pretty. I mean, they're pretty cool books. It's a cool concept. Hellraiser, Cenobites through the ages. And then again, my big goal now is to collect all the Nightbreeds again, mm-hmm. because I remember reading them and enjoying them.
Yeah, I read bits and pieces and liked them. It was good stuff.
Well, because they would do a... You had your central story, and then they would always throw these nice little 2-3 issue stories. I didn't realize all that was epic. I'm going to actually try to go back and try to collect these old epic comics.
Yeah. And that's the thing, too, is as much as I've ripped on the writing quality of these books, I just went on to better things. Margaret Clark, she jumped from Marvel to DC and started editing the Star Trek comic books there. That transitioned her to pocketbooks, and she became one of the major editors of Star Trek novelizations up until just a few years ago. It's not like these people have an absence of talent. They were just not working on the right properties, and they did not have the skill set yet to properly manage a universe.
Yeah.
Not very many writers do, and especially new writers. The quality of cronyism that comes with having an editor-in-chief take his editors and let them go off and write their own line of comics, they just clearly weren't ready for it. But they did go on to better things. They're not terrible people. I'm not saying they should be burned in effigy or anything. They just made some rough comic books off of some cool concepts.
Well, let me ask you this. Now that you've thrown that at us, because I remember reading on Facebook or something about how Marvel was putting up all these old posters like Maestro. And I guess it's
That's what all that was. Well, Days of Future Past is part of that.
I was thinking, that's kind of weird. Didn't we already read this?
Mm-hmm.
I read this a long time ago.
Well, they're mostly continuations of. If you look, they're like updated versions. Like they're showing you that they're doing something a little bit different with those premises. And that's what they're doing. They're all going to end up on Battleworld fighting each other in the new Secret Wars.
That'd be interesting. That's interesting.
I'm seriously considering picking that one up because that sounds like the kind of book that's so weird and unpredictable as far as what the heck they're going to do with it. I see what's going to happen with it. I'm not guaranteeing I'm going to do it because I'm sure.
No. You just made a promise.
No, I did not make a promise.
You just sold your soul for it.
Most Marvel books.
6 issues, you can pull it off.
It's not going to be 6 issues. I think it's going to be something like 8 to 12. And at $4+ a piece, I'm not sure how down I am with that.
How much?
Most Marvel books start at $4, and this is going to be a painted miniseries. It's probably going to be $5-6 an issue. I'm not sure if I'm willing to commit to that. I'm thinking about it, which is more than I do for most comic books these days from the big two.
Make a commitment. Don't be a pussy.
I'm going to be a fucking pussy. I'm totally going to be a fucking pussy on this because I don't want to spend that much money. I don't want to spend half of that. And I know what's going to happen. Let's face it, it's a painted miniseries. You think there's going to be production delays? I wouldn't be surprised if there were some production delays.
Right.
Yeah. I'm so far behind on the Marvel Universe, it doesn't matter anymore. I'm reading stuff now. People are like, oh, I read that 2 years ago. I'm like, I read it last night. It was pretty good. I'm that guy now.
Do you enjoy parallel worlds and alternate realities? Who doesn't? That's why the Superblog team-up will devote their January 2015 crossover to Multiversity. Get strung out on string theory with these amazing blogs. The conjoined Amazing Spider-Talk, Chasing Amazing, and Superior Spider-Talk will discuss the Spider-Man miniseries Reign. Between the Pages will take you to A Tale of Two Cities on the Edge of Forever. Bronze Age Babies ask you to join them on a magical mystery tour of the multiverse with Things Are a Little Different Around Here. Firestorm Fan will take on the Nuclear Man on Infinite Earth with Countdown Arena. Flodo's page will examine an Earth-1, Earth-2 team-up featuring Green Lantern. In My Not-So-Humble Opinion, we'll explore the mini-worlds of Tesla Strong. The Legion of Superbloggers will look into Star Trek Legion of Superheroes. Longbox Graveyard will dig up X-Men number 141 and 142, Days of Future Past. The Idlehead of Diablo podcast will give you an overview of Martian Manhunter Multiversity. The Mystery Vlog will look at Marvel and DC's secret crossover, Avengers 85 through 86, the first appearance of Squadron Supreme. Superhero Satellite will shine a light on Marvel Comics' Star Comics line in Licensed Reality and Parallel Properties. The Ultraverse Network will take you to Altered Reality, the Ultraverse before and after Black September. And the Unspoken Decade does the math on 5 Batman, 1 Superman, 0 Hour. Links to these wonderful podcasts, vlogs, and blogs can be found at the blog of this podcast. We received Twitter follows from Andrew Leyland of Views from the Long Box and Hey Kids Comics Podcast, Anthony Durso of The Toy Room, Corey Buckner, Count Druncula under some other random identity, Doug Zawissa, who is a reviewer for Comic Book Resources and has written a book or two for Tomorrow's. He also runs a Red Tornado blog and a Doom Patrol blog. Someone whose name I can't pronounce because it's a bunch of kanji, but it's at Sabi Javajis. Okay. Emet Comics, who are trying to do comics that empower women creators and characters. Epic Podcasts, Horace Austin, Jordan Russ, K&M Comics, New World Comics, Pedro Cabezuelo, Picturehead, Player FM, Podcast of the Day, Richard C. Meyer, and Rob Kelly of the Fire and Water Podcast and Wanting to Murder Illegal Machine fame. Twitter favorites came from Ange, Between the Pages, Bill Baer, Chris Callahan, Chris William, CG at Black Girl Manifest, CJ, Count Druncula, David Fior, David Golding Artist, Eel Perrin, Eternal Rage, Fantastiverse, Father Shepherd, Firestorm Fan, Future Primitive, Gaming Yesterday, Geekin' Out, The Irredeemable Shag, J. David Weeder, Knowing Flame Comics, Hashtag Marvelous at DJ Dub Floyd, Martin Gray, Mystery Vlog, Professor Riptide, Randy Caldwell, Randy Micah Smith, Storybreakers, Sin, Arkham Green Lantern, Army of Skanks, David Morgan, DCU Movie Page, Floto Span, Kyle Pettit, Sean Reyes, Tony D, Vernon Johnson, the Top 5 Road Crew, and We Are Wakanda. Bodacious Retweets were brought to you by Abbe, Professor Alan Middleton, Ange, Between the Pages, Bill Bear, CJ, Comics Therapy, Count Druncula, Eternal Rage, Fantastiverse, Firestorm Fan, Future Primitive, Geekin' Out, Guano Man, Harrison Richards, J. David Weeder, Keith G. Baker, Knowing Flame Comics, Hashtag Marvelous, Mystery Vlog, Peter Hutchins, Randy Caldwell, Randy Micah Smith, Sin, Top 5 Road Crew, and We Are Wakanda.
So then what was it? Valiant was Solar.
Right. Valiant was Jim Shooter after he'd been kicked out of Marvel. He wanted to show those guys that he could raise up another universe the way he'd raised up Marvel. Because Marvel was in the shit back in the 70s. They were just so badly managed that the whole company was basically falling apart. And Jim Shooter's what turned them into a profitable juggernaut. The model served Marvel very well over the years. When he went to Valiant, he got a group of investors together and they got the licenses for the old Gold Geek characters like Magnus and Dr. Solar and Turok. They started a whole new comic book company with almost nobody known in comics. They're either new guys who'd never done comics before, or they were old ass, tired artists like Don Perlin. The only real names he had in the beginning were Bob Layton and Barry Windsor Smith. They managed to turn Valiant into a major contender. And then they fired Jim Shooter's ass screwed him out of his share of the company. He had to go off and try to form two more companies, Defiant and Broadway, after the fact. But none of them managed to reach the heights of Valiant. Valiant, as you may recall, borrowed a shit ton of concepts from the new universe.
Yeah.
Harbinger was basically DP7. Starbrand and Solar were not dissimilar from one another.
Though Solar had a very cool... I still own the first... Was a hardback edition of the original six or seven
Barry Windsor Smith inserts from the first 9 issues. Yes. They told its origin.
Yeah. And that's a great story. Like, I still go back and read that one.
It's basically a Dr. Manhattan comic, but it's really good. So I hate to diminish
the
it.
The artwork is just fucking phenomenal.
Barry Smith, you know, I mean, he's a comic art god, but it's been so long since he's done anything that nobody ever talks about him anymore. But it's beautiful. It holds up so well.
The detail that he put into it. Spoilers. The one when he goes to hug his wife and he blasts that radiation at her and just annihilates her. And all the detail in the house. And I mean, it was a great book.
I love because Valiant were pioneers in coloring. And you remember, used to have all those energy raids where like gradations of different colors and stuff. It was gorgeous. It was so much more vibrant than anything else that was going at that point in time.
And of course, I really enjoyed Bloodshot was a good book. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed. What was that? Rye. That was definitely Magnus.
Magnus was underrated because a lot of people kind of forgot about that book because of the man running around in his skirt. And it was never one of the bigger sellers for Valiant. It was always the one that struggled the most. But it's the book that, through Marvel, did they launch with Magnus and then Solar followed? Isn't that what happened?
I believe Solar was first, then Magnus, Ra.
Well, Ra spun out of Magnus.
They're both set in
the 30th century.
They did that same thing where that books were interconnected. Okay. You could read Archer and Armstrong. You could read that, and you didn't have to read Solar, but they would make appearances in the other book. What's another French song? There's another one that's always popular.
Blue, blue, my love is blue.
This is what a serial killer sings like as he's walking through your house murdering a family. It's like, no, too creepy.
How about the Manuel theme?
How's that one going?
I don't remember.
My
Love is Blue, I believe, was Claudine Lau J. So, no, that wasn't porn. But the Emmanuel theme actually, who did that one? Was it Serge Gainsbourg? It was a crossover hit, though. It did well, at least in Europe. I don't know if it did anything here in the States.
But are you talking about the porny movies?
Yeah, softcore porn movies.
Yeah. Okay.
They were huge hits back in the 70s, though.
Yeah. Tino Brass rules.
Tino Brass didn't do one of those, though.
I know, but his movies rule. They're like porny without being too porny.